Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome to another episode of Central Line. I'm your host and editor, Dr. Adam Stryker. Our guest today is Dr. Dan Cole, professor of anesthesiology at UCLA and past president of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. We're going to be hearing more from Dr. Cole in the pages of the Monitor, so we've invited him here today to talk about his plans and his expertise, which is in the field of brain health. Welcome to the show, Dr. Cole.
Thank you, Adam.
Well, I imagine most of our listeners probably already know a bit about you, but go ahead and tell us a little bit about your career path and how your interest in brain health came about.
Well, in a nutshell, I'm a neuroanesthesiologist, neuroscientist by training. I spent about first 20 years of my career doing bench research, a laboratory model of focal cerebral ischemia, and have had a longstanding interest in neuroscience as it intersects with anesthesiology. About 25 to 30 years ago, I got involved in organized medicine and quickly realized that this was an area where my efforts could have impact on healthcare broadly. And 15 or 20 years ago, my career kind of took a left turn, so to speak, leading to a broad engagement on national organized medicine, particularly the ASA, that culminated in my being ASA president about 4 years ago.
Excellent. Now, you were involved in creating the Brain Health Initiative in 2015. Can you talk a little bit about the initial goals of that initiative?
Well, I've always had a keen interest in patient safety, and patient safety, as I learned in my residency, had a lot to do with medication errors, you know, getting your gas lines not switched, et cetera. But thinking even more broadly, patient safety is defined in preventable harm or harm that results from the processes of care. And preventable harm is several studies have shown, and the methodology is a little suspect, but several studies have shown that it is the third leading cause of death in the United States. And we are a patient safety organization. We have skills in patient safety. And our specialty is at the frontier of patient care, addressing what matters most to our patients, really their health span. We are no longer a specialty that is just induction to emergence, but we are a specialty that works as teams throughout the episode of care, vying to return the patient home with improved functional, psychological, and cognitive health. And so as I started to think about the year I was going to be president, you develop your agenda ahead of time. And so we put together a small group of people that were experts and thought leaders in patient safety that thought, what are some of the things that we can start focusing on that will have this broad impact? And there were a number of different areas that came up, for instance, myocardial injury after non-cardiac surgery. But we ended up focusing on brain health, which is of significant interest to every one of us, certainly as we age. And we engendered to try and create a multidisciplinary group to work with providers, payers, and the public to really create a program to minimize the impact of post-operative brain dysfunction in adults 65 and older.
I imagine not only is it costly to the patients in terms of their function, but to the healthcare system at large. I imagine this is an incredibly expensive issue if not dealt with properly.
Yeah, well, certainly, like you stated, there is a human cost of this. But when you start to think about the healthcare system, there was guidelines published by the American Geriatric Society that about 2014, I believe, that stated that the delirium, just one part of postoperative cognitive dysfunction, is a $150 billion problem annually, and about 40% of those cases can be prevented. And delirium per se is just a slice of the pie of a postoperative brain dysfunction, and it certainly can lead to human costs outside of just the healthcare costs, and reallocating 40% of $150 billion to other priorities, boy, would that have a great impact.
No, absolutely. Well, looking back over the last few years, do you feel that you've achieved those goals or at least gotten close?
Yeah, so we viewed this as a marathon, a long game, and certainly we're not ready to spike the ball in the end zone, but to use the sports metaphor, we have moved the chains down the field. We've worked collaboratively with many organizations, including patient groups like AARP, to advance recommendations and increase the profile and kind of put out their best practices for healthcare providers, anesthesiologists, and healthcare systems to minimize the impact of this potential problem.
Well, you're now contributing to ASA's monitor on a regular basis, and I'm wondering how that came about. Is that something that's always appealed to you or something that just came up recently?
Well, I've always been kind of a part of the monitor through my roles at ASA, been asked to contribute to it a lot. And I certainly do think highly of the monitor as a vehicle for information and communication about what's going on in their field. And when it came to brain health, about a year ago, I was asked to start to write a column on brain health. And of course, I jumped on that. And that certainly is a passion of mine and of keen interest to our patients and many anesthesiologists that I talk to. And so it's a little unique in that so far, I've been the sole author of this column only once. I've tried to solicit co-columnists to contribute to the diversity of this column and the spread of information on many different topics as it relates to brain health.
When you wrote an article for the November issue on the effects of anesthesia on dementia, can you tell us a little bit about the key takeaways?
Well, in short, again, I solicited two co-columnists from Mayo Clinic. And it went over data from a Mayo Clinic database with these two primary authors. The findings of the studies and what we wrote up in the column suggests that anesthesia itself does not cause cognitive decline, but rather factors such as the underlying condition necessitating surgery, the inflammatory responses caused by surgery or major illnesses are really the key factor. And there is a deterioration in patients' brain health as a large cohort, but it's worth emphasizing, according to these studies, which are really well done, that the magnitude of the decline is relatively small and that there is necessarily a key link, according to these studies, between anesthesia and surgery and a future diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But there certainly are lingering concerns about how surgery requiring anesthesia acutely affects brain health and certainly the development of delirium.
What are some things we can do as anesthesiologists to help mitigate that risk?
Well, there's a lot of things, and I would suggest that everyone consider a best practice pathway for these patients, which involves preoperative assessment optimization. Certainly, you can look at a patient's medications, and I refer to a Beers criteria of high-risk medications in the chronic outpatient type setting, which may have some impact short-term. One of the worst offenders is using benzodiazepines. Preoperatively, you can assess the patient for risk using things like the mini-cog exam, a frailty exam. There are prehabilitation pathways a patient can undergo for several weeks prior to surgery. And you can get a geriatrician involved as a kind of a steady state throughout the total process. Intraoperatively, there are some things that you can do. It's pretty controversial, but possibly depth of anesthesia, making sure that you're not overdosing the patient, avoiding hypotension. There is no optimal anesthetic, and it doesn't seem to matter whether patients get regional versus general, and maybe even glycemic control. But probably almost as important, if not more important, is postoperatively when they wake up, making sure that these patients have the ability to get reoriented. And one of the things I always do, if I can, get a family member close to the patient in the recovery room and in the immediate first day or two, treat pain aggressively, make sure they get good sleep, get them up and about and physical activity if possible. If they have hearing aids or glasses, put those in as quickly as possible. That gives them sensory input to help kind of reorient. And if possible, the sooner you can get them home into a familiar surrounding, the better off they will be.
As anesthesiologists, you know, we like immediate gratification and seeing the results of our work right after a surgery, for instance. Obviously, a lot of us practice in pain clinics and outpatient settings as well. But this seems to me to be a problem that really illustrates the positive impact as a comprehensive physician that anesthesiologists can provide to patients, being that there is no one discrete medication to give. There's no one discrete anesthetic technique to provide. It's the comprehensive care and the persistent care throughout the perioperative period that ultimately can make the difference. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think you've stated that eloquently. I think when I first started off in anesthesiology, medicine was a little bit more of a tribal type of organization. And, you know, physicians, Atul Gawande said it best in an article that he said, physicians are no longer cowboys, but pit crews. And by that, I think he meant whatever analogy you, how you want to interpret that. But we work together as teams in the best interest of the patient. And that goes from soup to nuts, so that when a surgeon first makes a diagnosis that requires surgery, then we start to work together in teams of 5, 10, 15, or 20 or more people may touch that patient throughout their perioperative period. And even when they get home, there certainly can be home care. And we are integral to that care. And we can oftentimes even lead, initiate, and improve the care that the patient gets. After all, that's why we went into medicine.
What do you think about how brain health is currently being measured? Do you think we are doing a good job, or is it something we need to improve on?
There certainly are gaps to improve. There are fairly simple tests that can be a pretty good estimate of measuring brain health without taking extensive psychometric tests. One preoperatively that one could take is the MINICOG, which essentially asks the patient or tells the patient three words, asks them to draw a certain time on a clock, and they will draw that time or not. And then you ask them to repeat those words. And that usually takes about 2 minutes and is a reasonable predictor of their brain health. Actually, after a surgery, you can administer relatively simple tests such as the CAM-ICU, which then can measure yes or no, is this patient having an episode of delirium? And those things are not well subscribed to throughout the nation. And certainly we can improve on these tests simply to improve the assessment of brain health.
We always talk about this as a problem in the elderly. Is there an age cutoff, or is this something we should be attending to a lot sooner in adulthood than we have been?
Well, certainly I think anybody is at risk of having, but age is one of the strongest predictors and risk of having postoperative cognitive dysfunction. And so age, and I kind of have a cutoff of around 60 to 70, realizing that I took care of a patient that was 90 the other day that actually looked and cognitively was more like a 60-year-old. And you'll take care of 60-year-olds that are like 80 or 90. And so age is not an absolute, but somewhere around 60 years old, I start to get concerned about risk, and the literature would say above 65 to 70 is where the risk demarcation really starts to take off.
Gotcha. Well, I understand there's an article on COVID and the brain planned for the January issue of the Monitor, and COVID patients seem to be experiencing an array of effects on the brain from things like loss of taste to confusion. And I was wondering, especially now that the cases are, at the time of this recording, the cases are certainly going up again all over the country. Do you have a sense of why that is, or any idea from your reading of the research on how COVID impacts the brain?
Well, here's the literature, and there is no definitive answer to your questions, but I'll kind of update with you with what the literature is in November of 2020. Certainly, infections per se can cause neurological disorders. And indeed, if somebody has a neurological, an acute neurological condition, infection is usually a search for. But it remains unclear whether adverse neurological effects on the brain are specific to SARS-CoV-2 or possibly even a more general phenomenon related to inflammation, cytokine storm, or the immune response that is a central driver of critical illness overall. SARS-CoV-2 is known to replicate in neurons and may actually enter the central nervous system via the angiotensin-converting enzyme 2 receptor. However, there is a case series of brain autopsies performed in patients with confirmed COVID that did not show any specific changes in the brain that could be directly attributable to SARS-CoV-2. Be that as it may, although a direct causal link between SARS-CoV-2 and neurological complications is biologically plausible, the supporting evidence is embryonic in nature. But the bottom line is that patients with COVID are well documented to have neurological problems. At least half of COVID patients present with neurological symptoms, and certainly even more develop symptoms during their hospitalization. And one final point is that we're understanding now that there are more patients now that are experiencing long COVID or symptoms of COVID, not just neurologic, but symptoms that persist for months following infections. The neurological symptoms for long COVID include fatigue, mood swings, cognitive difficulties, and brain fog. Long COVID may indeed impact population health, that is yet to be determined, and may have sustained consequences. And an unanswered question now is that when is somebody, particularly after they've had long COVID, okay to come back for the stresses of surgery and anesthesia and possibly undergo another inflammatory response? Again, the data is embryonic, but it is a big question that we need to answer.
How are researchers studying these impacts specifically? Is it just clinical research based on case cohorts or case studies? Or is it everything laboratory, pathologic? Everything?
Yeah, it's all. I mean, there certainly are a lot of case series that are being published. There are very few randomized controlled trials, with this. So that data is kind of lacking. And then there are laboratory studies that are done, for instance, showing that SARS-CoV-2 can indeed replicate inside neurons, again, which makes it biologically plausible that SARS-CoV-2 can enter the patient's nervous system through the olfactory bulb and actually possibly remain in the CNS. Although, again, that has yet to be shown.
What are other topics you're most looking forward to addressing in the pages of the Monitor?
Well, the next one that's being planned and is being written up right now is a very controversial area, and that would be the use of processed electroencephalograms to determine anesthetic overdose and how that may or may not affect the incidence of neurological problems postoperatively. Another one that I think will be down the pike in the second or third article following that would be preoperative prehabilitation. And what are some of the things that have some reasonable amount of proof to do? What are some of the things that are plausible as far as having a positive effect? And what are some of the things that are kind of out there, but really have no data behind them as far as optimizing the patient for a surgery and anesthesia?
Well, you mentioned using processed EEG to look at anesthetic depth. And it seems that the evidence is certainly clear, correct me if I'm wrong, that the proper utilization of EEG during anesthesia is quite revealing as far as information in real time about anesthetic depth. But I've always thought the kind of the knock on it was the proper interpretation piece and the ease of use during an anesthetic, hence things like, you know, the BIS monitor that have come to the forefront over the years to try to make it easier to interpret that data and boil it down to a more simpler approach. But what's your take on the overall use of EEG intraoperatively?
Very controversial and not a lot of evidence. I mean, there is evidence, but not overwhelming evidence on either side. You can make that the argument for either side. And I think you stated it well, that in general, electroactivity in the brain correlates well to anesthetic depth. Exactly what happens in a processed electroencephalogram and how it relates to the particular anesthetic or anesthetics you are using is a little questionable, and how that depth of anesthesia relates per se to a neurological outcome postoperatively is fairly suspect in a large cohort of patients. In general, the way that I've interpreted the data for my practice, and this is my opinion, is that I would use a processed EEG on high-risk patients to avoid overdose, which is something that I think in general we do not want to do, and to avoid underdose, which may actually also produce some harm, in that underdose means the patient's light and they may be stressing the physiological system and the biology of the brain.
Well, Dr. Cole, you're obviously contributing to the ASA monitor now quite a bit. And I'm wondering, just to get your take on the new format and your impression of how people are receiving it.
Well, my position as a reader, I think it's spectacular. It is a great step forward. It's very readable. The articles are very relevant. And I like the new revised format. That said, I am sure that the ASA is always trying to improve their products. And certainly the monitor is probably iterative in the sense of we are always open to feedback from the people who use the monitor due to how we can best meet their needs. So again, as one of 50,000 people that read the monitor, I give it an A+.
Yeah, I've been impressed with it as well. And for our listeners, if you're interested in Dr. Cole's writings or any of the subject matter about brain health, please go to the ASA Monitor website, asamonitor.org, and you can access all that information there. Well, is there anything else you'd like our audience to know regarding brain health initiatives, things we can do, things you'd like people to be aware of as we close out?
Yeah, I thank you for that question. I think in general, we have an aging demographic in the United States of patients over 65, and that is only going to increase in the next 2 to 3 decades. These patients certainly are highly concerned about their brain health. And I get patients that come in all the time asking me, please don't do that again to me. I've had a patient say, I would rather die than lose my memory. And so, well, hard science isn't there to answer all of the questions. Best practices and consideration by us, the physicians who have responsibility for these patients, is there. And it is something extremely important to our patients. And I would urge everyone to consider what the best practices are.
Well, thank you very much. How do you assuage those fears for those patients that are concerned? That is not an insignificant concern. And I'd be interested to hear a little bit about what you tell them when they don't want to be put to sleep.
First, I think it's important as a human being and certainly a physician to be honest, upfront, and transparent with them. After all, their body is the one that, you know, their humanness is what is undertaking the risk. And so I don't shy away from telling them what I think the real risks are. But they are here to have something that is needed, not frivolous. And so we go over the statistics of what their chances are. So I do a risk assessment with them. Here are some of the things that I'm going to do to really minimize the chances of this happening. And if indeed it does happen, here's some of the things that we're going to do to kind of decrease the impact of this, on your life. So again, I think we owe the patient honesty and we owe them the best practice in November of 2020 or whenever you are taking care of this patient.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cole. This is such an important topic. It really does underscore the importance of what it is we do as physician anesthesiologists and the kind of impact we can have on our patients. So I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is Adam Stryker, thanking everyone for joining us on another episode of Centraline. Please tune in again next time.
Cut through daily noise and dive into the ASA Monitor, your leading source for perioperative healthcare news. Read the latest source today at asamonitor.org. Subscribe to Centraline today, wherever you get your podcasts, or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.